And our first case this morning is A19-1414, Malberg versus Gustafson et al. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes for your oral arguments, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it for appellants. Go ahead and take the podium. Looks a little high. Maybe that's good for you. It adjusts up and down. There's a toggle
thank you.
Switch.
Seems to be okay.
It looks good, actually. So when you're ready, just state the name and a party you represent for the record, if you would.
All right. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Chamberlain. I represent Mark Gustafson and M&M Methods, what I would incorporate it. I'd like to start the oral argument this morning with just a brief point as a business lawyer who represents a lot of independently held businesses, closely held businesses. And one of the reasons that my clients incorporate is for liability protection. And that's something that is favored in the law. It's true in every jurisdiction in the United States, and there's nothing inherently wrong about it. And Victoria Elevator said so. It should not be a gotcha or a trapdoor for someone to lose that unless there's some pretty compelling reasons. It's a seldom granted claim for a piercing of a veil, and it always has some element of fundamental injustice here. I can say this, that both prongs of the Victoria Elevator have to be shown, of course, but I think the overall perspective is that it is an analysis that has to be looked at globally. It has to be looked at like a forest, not like a number of trees. However, even if you look at the trees from a standpoint, they favor us. For example, the trial court found that there was no alter ego between Mark Gustafson and the corporation. It was not used as a facade, they found. Said it was sufficiently capitalized at the time it was started, and it was not insolvent at the time of the transaction in question. The corporate formalities that the trial court objected to, we think are simply incorrect. It said that there were no corporate records because there were no manual minutes of directors and shareholders that were done over the years, but it's not true because in section 302A.231, it uses the word that you may do that, it's discretionary. And in the bylaws of the corporation, in section 309, or exhibit 309, on page 62 in the bylaws, says that corporation does not need to have annual minutes and does not need to have annual meetings. It may do that, but it's not required to do that. I'd like to start with the focal point here is that the fundamental fairness and injustice for the second prong is glaringly wrong here. If you have the non-payment of the plaintiff as being evidence of the injustice, you then would have done away with the entire analysis, because that's going to be true in every single case. There has to be a non-payment or there wouldn't be a plaintiff and there wouldn't be a claim. We cited authority, not in Minnesota, but from other jurisdictions, saying that you have to have something more than non-payment. The only objection that was in the respondent's brief was that it wasn't precedential, but there's no rationale to argue against that, to say that simple non-payment is enough. The trial court found it unfair that when there was a, quote, undisputed 70% payment agreement, but it found it unfair to contest the case, but it's not accurate to do that in the context of litigation. We had claimed that there were overpayments. There's no question that there were hidden cells that Mr. Malberg had created inside of the invoice log, that these are ones that Mr. Gustafson didn't know about. And if you think about it from an Excel spreadsheet standpoint, there would be no reason to hide a whole bunch of evidence in your log when it's right there. And they can't be justified through anything other than at least suspicion about it. Now, the argument...
I just want to be clear on one of the facts. I thought I understood that those hidden cells really contained information about the compensation agreement before 2013. Is that not correct?
I think it's true, but it has the effect after 2013 because of the overpayment and carry forward. In fact, trial judge Judge Peterson said at page 10 of his summary judgment order, overpayment prior to 2013 might eventually offset the amount that he had awarded on the summary judgment.
I guess my concern about your injustice argument kind of on the payment front is if your client had paid something. There seemed to be agreement that, you know, on some parts of this compensation agreement, you know, and whether it's 70% of, you know, net or gross, that something was owed and he wasn't paid anything. I mean, that I think is troubling to me on the injustice front. So could you please address that?
Yes, I will, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. In this case here, it's a little different than the usual employer-employee relationship. There's two employees. During the period of the fiscal year before, from the one that ended in December, on June 30, 2014, they didn't have any regular payments at all. He got all of his pays at the for the whole year in the last few days of the whole year. He went many more months after that, and then there were some payments in November and December of 2014. And so there wasn't a case of a regular payment where you'd say that this is ordinary. He said that, you know, he looked, and in fact, there's an explanation of this by Mr. Gustafson, said, you know, I've seen a lot of things in your record here of wrongdoing. You're charging things for your kids' toys and your wife's car and your boat trailer, and I need to look at this thing and analyze it. And he also felt that there was the overpayment, and he said that now if there were a calculation of the amount that was owing, that would have been something that would have to be done through evidence at trial. If he had paid something when there was a claim, for example, that he was owing, he took part of the business of the company. In turn, it was undisputed that he took 90% of the accounts, simply drained the corporation of all assets, and he had taken that and he now runs it after the business, and that had gone on right at the time. So the context of why pay something, I understand that it may have been something that could have been done, but that would presume the outcome of the case and the offsets, which were unknown. And so the logical time to do that is when those are determined. When there's an offsetting claim to what he's asking for, I think that's the point. He has not yielded on the point. He said, you would not have paid me anyway unless you pay me 70% of the, not of the gross profit, but the gross sales, gross revenue, meaning that all other expenses have to come out of the 70%. And so I think it's more complicated than saying, why didn't you just pay something here? Because what do you pay? How do you know what it is until you get to calculate it? I mean, it would be, and if you have a tripwire on that where you defend a lawsuit where there are claims that were much more than this.
I guess, but and perhaps this also goes to the application of Minnesota Statute 181.03 too, but isn't that the whole idea of this? Employees should have certainty about what their commissions are and, you know, and they should be paid what they're due, and isn't that a lot of that certainty fall on the shoulders of the employer, here your client?
Well, I think it clearly would be the obligation to comply with 181.03 sub 2. That, however, that is a penalty that only applies where there is a change in the timing method and procedure of a payment of salary after termination of employment. And opposing counsel said it doesn't matter when it happens, but it does matter. The statute says when it occurs. There is there's no doubt that there is some push in the statute that says that you make payments, but it does not say that if there's a disputed amount of a payment, you have to pay. There's nothing like that there. And if you look at the statute for 181.02 for the commission, he's claiming a commission here. And that 181.03 that Your Honor cited only pertains to commissions and nothing else.
Mr. Chamberlain,
yes.
In reviewing your briefs and your very well-written arguments, it seems to me that the district court could have gone the other way on some of these things, but did not. And since we're an error-correcting court, particularly on the piercing the corporate veil issue, where our standard review is abuse of discretion, explain to me how the district court abused its discretion on the fundamental fairness argument, following up on Judge Jessen's excellent question.
Okay. I think the fundamental fairness argument can't be considered without regard to the summary judgment motion that was done at the trial court, because there were disputes between the two parties. One said the invoice log was accurate and undisputable, and my client said it's not. It's filled with accuracies and it's wrong, and there's overpayments that are made. And trial judge said—
But that's different from the agreement. I mean, it seems to me the district court relied on one of your responses to say, okay, we'll have a trial on the damages, but we're not going to have a trial on the agreement, and the invoice logs are the invoice logs, and, you know, we'll see that is. But in terms of piercing the corporate veil and not so much whether there was an agreement or not, why, in looking at the district court's opinion, why couldn't they, what was wrong with the court finding that It was subdivision two, the attempts to delay or reduce the amount of payment. Where is the abuse of discretion in making that holding as to one of the reasons for piercing the corporate veil under the fundamental fairness prong?
For one thing, Your Honor, I think that the standard of review on a motion for summary judgment being granted and drawing inferences against the non-moving party, that's a matter of law.
But here, well, maybe I'm confused. I thought you had a trial on piercing the corporate veil. Wasn't there a hearing on that? I thought there was a two-day hearing.
No, there was a hearing on that.
Okay.
But
So if that's abuse of discretion, well, do we agree that we review the court's determination of whether or not it was error to pierce the corporate veil under the abuse of discretion standard?
Your Honor, I agree with you that. Okay. That is the standard, but I'd like to...
Go right ahead.
And then,
at some point, I would like to get back to subdivision two and why it was inappropriate for the court to rule the way it did on that. But go ahead before you answer that question.
Okay. It depends. The outcome of the trial of the amount owed depends on the resolution that actually got done beforehand in the summary judgment order. So we had contested that, and we were not able to bring that up at trial. I tried to make an offer of proof on evidence at trial, and the trial court said no. That is got to be the basis of the claim. If that's not good, if we wipe that out, there would be no reason to pierce anything. And so the claim that we had made at trial was that the offsets equaled the amount that had been paid and that there wasn't anything owing.
Right. But you lost.
But what?
But you lost. But
I didn't know that in advance, and I should not have lost in summary judgment, because if you got conflicting evidence in summary judgment, you say, I'm going to make an inference that one side's right and one side's wrong. And then I try to make an offer of proof and I get deprived. Of course I'm going to lose that if you rule that major disputes about the invoice log or about whether it's gross or net payments then become how much is owed.
Can I ask some questions about summary judgment? So at the point of summary judgment, what evidence, well, let me ask you this. In your brief, I think that your evidence, I want to know what evidence there was that you put for your client put forward that net profits was the understanding around the 70% as opposed to gross profits. And maybe I missed something, but what I see is at the point of summary judgment, a declaration from Mr. Gustafson. Does he have only one declaration?
There was only one that was in the summary judgment.
At summary judgment. Okay.
And then
in summary judgment, I think in your brief, what you rely on is a paragraph when he talks about, or what the district court relied on was a paragraph in which he talked about that he acquiesced in paying 70% of service. Specifically, Malberg demanded 70% of all the corporation's billing for work. I don't agree that he should get that, plus profit on sales and new machines. And it says, M&M Systems only acquiesced to Malberg's demand for a 70% on commission on service work performed by Malberg, never agreed to sales, part sales, et cetera. So there's no mention in that paragraph that I just referred to about net or gross.
I think there was in,
And I have this question so the red in the red brief, so there can be preparation for that. In the red brief, there's talk on page 48 of the red brief talking about Gustafson's declaration stating that 70% of hourly pay was to be based on gross proceeds after expenses, not total receipts. And there's reference to gross. I don't find that language in the declaration.
I'm wondering,
I would like both parties to correct me on this. Is there trial testimony on gross versus net, which is after summary judgment? Is there anything at the point of summary judgment that talks about gross versus net?
That is where we had raised it. It was in paragraphs 12 through 14 of the declaration that was by Mark Gustafson, and it was dated May 9, 2017. It was before the motion for summary judgment.
Paragraphs 12 through 19.
No, through 14.
Through 14. And so where does it, in paragraphs 12 through 14, where does it talk about 70% of what in paragraphs 12 through 14? Because the district court decided it must be gross profits because that's what the invoice categories would lead to. And in fact, those were the amounts paid. And so based on that, decided that 70% must mean gross, not net. But I guess maybe I'm just not understanding paragraphs 12 through 14, which I don't think you cited in the brief as where we should look, but to figure out why those tell us that it's gross for, or net, excuse me, versus gross.
I know that the argument was made in there. It was also followed up with a motion or a request under Rule 115 for reconsideration.
I understand arguments. I'm looking for the evidence that the district court, the admissible evidence on summary judgment of district court would be looking at to ascertain what the 70% was based on. Because I don't think that's even discussed in the deposition testimony that was submitted. Like, it's not specific to this. And, of course, in Rule 50, you have to, I'm going over a little bit, but you need to have admissible evidence that creates a genuine issue of fact as to meaning, et cetera.
True, but I think that when we went to trial and tried to talk about that, the trial judge said that sort of...
Trial is after summary judgment, though.
Right.
So maybe think about this, and then on rebuttal, if there's something more we should be looking at. But it's helpful to me to know that our universe at summary judgment is the declaration and any deposition testimony, presumably.
All right.
Right? Okay, good.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I took up time. Is there anything for my colleagues on this? Okay, counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Kristen Kingsbury, and I'm here on behalf of respondent Brett Malberg. Before I start, I just want to hit a couple housekeeping issues in my argument. First of all, regarding the 181.03 argument, the court correctly asked some questions on the import of that, both in the piercing the corporate veil, but also the certainty that the statutory regime affords employees, and was a violation of 181.03 sub 2, did that occur here? What came to my attention yesterday was a case, and I did let Mr. Chamberlain know about this yesterday as well, called Toyota Lift of Minnesota versus American Warehouse, and the citation is 886 Northwest 2D 208. It's a 2016 Supreme Court case, and the page citation is 214. And a very similar argument that's raised here before the Court of Appeals was raised there, which is pertaining to offsetting as a justification for not paying what is undisputably owed in wages or commissions. And while that case dealt with 181.14, that statute, if you look at the very beginning, indicates that that statute, anything in that statute pertains to 181.13, which was the statute at play here. And so this case applies to our case as well. In that case, the very last sentence of the opinion states, because we cannot supply the language that would give the district court the authority to offset liabilities, we hold that offsetting liabilities is not permitted. This is pertaining to offsetting liabilities with wage-based claims. This opinion stands for the proposition that anything that's non-wage-based cannot constitute an offsetting for purposes of withholding pay.
So I don't have that case in front of me. Is that a piercing the corporate veil case, too? Or is that
it's just a wage case, so I just want.
You better pay them.
Yes.
Or you can face these penalties.
Correct. So the
was incorrect. You're then to go to trial on the issue, because it did go to trial on the question, as the district court said in the summary judgment, that there could be offsets to what was owed. Was there, that mistaken? To try
there
that?
Can be offsets in terms of wage claims. So to the extent he was overpaid under the 2011 mm-hmm. engagement, that could constitute an offset.
Okay. So the so-called hidden cells problem, which related to pre-2013, could have been offset had it been proved to be something that should be offset.
Correct.
Okay.
And the court reserved that issue for trial. So that was completely fair game if evidence had been produced and presented at trial.
So what does Toyota do to advance your case?
What Toyota does is it takes away the justification for paying zero, not one penny, to Mr. Malberg. It supports the district court's summary judgment ruling that something was owed, and it all turns on the admission of Mr. Gustafson that he agreed that 70% on service work was the agreement.
Can you answer for me what, and I'm totally open to the idea that I'm missing it. I must be. On page 48 of your brief, when you say Gustafson's declaration and you quote from that declaration, do you have your brief there?
I do. Did you say page 48?
48, mm-hmm. And there's no citation to the record after a quote where you say his declaration stated, and I don't know why I'm not seeing that in his declaration. Are you quoting his declaration, do you think?
Let me see.
And maybe you don't know off the top of your head, but...
I have his declaration opened. I was looking for that myself. Hold on.
I mean, I raise this because we're on summary judgment, and the idea is whether there's any disputed facts. And here you're saying that he declared that what that is to be based on gross proceeds, et cetera. And that seems to be a lot of the dispute. But if you don't know immediately, I don't want to take too much time either. Away from
I
you.
Don't know immediately.
Okay.
It's possible I took that from the trial testimony instead.
Okay.
If we're not seeing it quickly, I apologize. It's not like me to have an inaccurate citation. So what I'm getting at is we know with 181.03 sub 2 that something was owed, and this was established defensibly, undisputably on the summary judgment record. And so we would urge that the partial summary judgment be affirmed in total based on that.
And so how's it supposed to work? If there could legitimately be offsets, what were the offsets that were being tried?
Well, thank you for the reminder. Most of the claims, the counterclaims brought against Mr. Malberg pertained to theft, overcompensating yourself during the 2011 period of time.
I'm sorry, what were they to offset? Were they to be an offset against the $134,000 that were awarded in summary judgment?
Correct.
And so what you're saying is that Toyota teaches an employer that they have to pay the commission owed of $134,000 even though there might be legitimate offsets that they could take against that amount? What are they supposed to understand that they're
You are not to withhold pay based on non-wage-based offsets, which was the basis for Mr. Gustafson withholding. He became suspicious that there was theft, and that was his justification at that time for not paying the commissions owed.
Okay.
And that is not allowed.
Okay. What about the offset that I think was argued related to the hidden cells? Like, was that like around 53,000 or something? I mean, was it legitimate to seek an offset of the commissions that he claimed? Didn't he not claim to that he overpaid commissions to the respondent?
So the hidden cells, my understanding of the hidden cells was that pertained to... Now I'm getting confused.
Like 2011, I think.
Yes, it pertained to the time frame not at issue here. But the invoice log, Judge Peterson stated, could be used for purposes of determining whether any legitimate offsets would be appropriate for trial. And so that is, in fact, what happened. The 134 was entered at partial summary judgment, but some offsets were established at trial, which adjusted that number. Now, that number had a few dips because there were some offsets that needed to occur based on expense reimbursement, and some commissions were determined to be not owed, commission structures that were not handled by the summary judgment ruling, such as 30% owed for service work that Mr. Gustafson completed. that was determined to fall out. So that was deducted from the 134.
I'm just trying to understand if the holding is that you employer pays wages that are owed but may deduct wages overpaid in the past. Is that what you're saying, or maybe you're not saying that?
The only offsets that are permitted are wage-based offsets.
Right, so you can offset overpayment of wages in the past.
Correct.
Okay, so what I was wondering here is if the point of owing commissions, if the employer could have offset overpayment of commissions made in the past, and was that not part of the dispute here?
It could have been part of the dispute had that evidence come in. No evidence to that effect came in. So even if, I don't know if 53,000 is the right number or not, let's say 53,000 was the number, and Mr. Gustafson and M&M knew that at the time they withheld the 70% commission.
Right.
Even so, the statutory regime requires that you pay what you in good faith believe you owe. So that would have been payment of something.
Something. Okay, that's what I was trying to get at.
Yes.
So it may not be the whole 70% if they have a belief that commissions were overpaid in the past.
Correct.
They could offset those at the point of where they owe the person under 181.
Correct. Okay. Yes. And that wasn't the evidence before the court. Okay. So,
was that not tried? Whether the 53 or the hidden cell payment was an overpayment, that wasn't tried as a potential offset?
The defendants did have an opportunity to produce and present evidence and testimony on offsets, but the court found that they did not prove any.
Right, they didn't prove it, but it was tried, was it?
It was tried, yes. So just quickly on the offer of proof, I would point the Court of Appeals to the addendum, page 58 through 61. In terms of, there's about 15 or 16 pages of discussion on Exhibit 141, and the sole purpose that it was offered for was to revisit summary judgment. An objection was made by plaintiff's counsel on the basis of irrelevance, and then also that Trial Exhibit 141 was never produced in discovery. And so this falls squarely within the discretion of the court, and I believe that it was the correct determination by the court to not allow for that document to come in. Now, abuse of discretion, the whole point of abuse of discretion is there some prejudice to the party attempting to bring that piece of evidence in, and here there wasn't. There would have been other ways to demonstrate, including evidence that would have been found in discovery for how to prove whatever offsets they wanted to prove. In addition, sometimes judges will say no offer of proof. Nothing stops an attorney from bringing a motion and filing it with the court. So there were avenues available for counsel to do that. And indeed, it certainly did not impede bringing a motion for a new trial or an appeal. We are here today. Both things happened.
Can you tell us, with respect to piercing the corporate veil, what makes this case different from Almack, where the district court was reversed on piercing, where it was a closely held corporation, husband, wife, et cetera?
Here, and I think it's important to look at the reason, again, the policy behind the first prong of the test and the second prong of the test. Here, the first prong of the test pertains to the relationship of the company and the principal. Frequently in the briefing by appellant, we see a conflating of that issue, and there's concern raised about how this, you know, the siphoning evidence or the non-functioning director evidence or the failure to honor corporate formalities or have documents maintained, those factors don't prejudice Mr. Malberg and therefore should not support undergoing that test. But that test has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the relationship of Mr. Gustafson and his company.
Right, and so why is this unlike Almack?
Okay, I don't think I can distinguish the facts for you today on that.
What are we to do with the fact that most of the factors seem to oppose piercing the corporate veil?
It has to do...
Was it 5-3? I can't remember.
I think so.
So, I mean, okay, close enough, but...
There is not a magical number. And, you know, I do find it...
I got that.
There is just a weighing of the factors and the nature of what was done.
So which one was the most important factor to the district court? Was it the size? It seems to me that what I seem to see over and over in the district court's order is it was really annoyed that these checks that were supposed to go to the corporation were never cashed. And, you know, that looked like funny business to it. So should we be focusing on that one?
I do believe the siphoning is the most critical factor. I believe Judge Abrams even said
I don't cash all the checks. I mean, in my house.
It wasn't just simply that. It was several factors. It was taking advances when there's no documentation or pattern or ritual that would tell you those are appropriate advances. There was the mileage issue, which... council underplays as not significant, but it's almost $32,000 over a period of 4 years. That's a lot of mileage that's being reimbursed at 58 cents a mile.
Was Mr. Malbert being reimbursed? I mean, I guess I don't really
His expenses for, well, I haven't looked at the mileage.
I mean, it doesn't look like, I mean, I understand the argument that siphoning is such a pejorative-sounding term, and it doesn't really look like Mr. Gustafson was... There aren't numbers to tell us he's getting rich under this facade and that's the purpose of it. And so they're just the numbers actually do look kind of low over a history of time.
Well, there's also the 54 checks, only four of which were ever reimbursed to the company. Under a rationale that the district court just did not buy at all.
And is there any dollar value assigned to those?
I'm sure there is in the record, but I don't have that at my fingertips.
I guess my big picture concern here is when you look at the dollars associated with the siphoning by Mr. Gustafson and compare those to the overall dollars in compensation that... Mr. Malbert received, you know, in those checks in 2014, and just overall, I mean, that don't we get to look at that what I would think of as an imbalance? The siphoning that he did doesn't seem to, you know, you could argue pales in comparison with the amount that that Mr. Malbert received.
Well, that's not the test. That's not how you determine it. But I understand proportionality. Maybe that is what you're getting at. It's very important to remember that $32,000 of mileage is only the tip of the iceberg with the evidence and the considerations that the district court reviewed. So it was the relationship of using this company, not even paying yourself a salary or anything, instead just using this company as your piggy bank. That's the test.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'd like to first address the point about the prongs. Because we had talked in my argument about the second prong, but really there have to be both prongs under the Victoria Elevator analysis. And in all of the factors, the eight factors, we really only have one that is arguable, because you cannot say that it was wrong not to have director minutes when the statute says you may have them and the bylaws say you don't have to do it. And you can't say that Ann Gustafson not acting as a director when she left, it's undisputed she left 2002 and she wasn't around, and that affected Malbert not at all. And so the only thing to talk about is the checks that were uncashed.
What evidence was there, though, that was operating as a corporation after it incorporated? I mean, it didn't file tax returns. The other director wasn't involved. I mean, does there need to be, is the act of incorporation sufficient, or is there more evidence to show it was acting like
that? I think there's several things. First of all, it always held itself out to be a corporation. All of the invoices all said it was incorporated. All the checks it wrote said it was incorporated. It was regularly filed every year with the Secretary of State that maintained the corporate existence, and it's a public record of that. If you have argument with the IRS, and there is a letter in here saying that I can't file my taxes until I get this case resolved because of the distinction about the deductions for payments that were made that he questioned. But the That would be between the IRS and him, but the IRS would have no ability, for example, to get rid of the corporate form or corporate existence. I mean, they kept their books. The problem that we have here is $31,000 over 3 years, at the same time when Mr. Gustafson made sure that all creditors were paid. In fact, Malberg was paid $321,000, and he got virtually nothing in 2 years, zero compensation at all, not even minimum wage. And over the 3 or 4 year period of time, $55,000 total. So the idea that he was siphoning, getting rich, and using it as his own piggy bank, why would he do that? I mean, he could have paid himself, for example, a salary of equal to $10,000 a year. That would be incontestable. But instead, he's saying, I have an offset, and he's got an offset for mileage. It isn't the doubt that he drove his personal car for the business, and he had to have a right to it. You may have arguments about how much he's entitled to, but you've only got a fairly small amount of money in relation to the whole picture anyway. And when you have a Victoria Elevator case in your first prong, where you completely lose on everything except this $31,000 of mischief, I don't think you've got the first prong at all. I argued the second prong for nonpayment, and I still think I'm right about that, but it takes both, and it needs that. If I could, I'd like to address something that was said in the Toyota Lift case. Toyota Lift case was nothing like this. That was a case that had was not involving 181.03. It was a case that involved 181.13 and 14. And in that case, there was a judgment that we received for Toyota Lift received for $800,000 against an LLC owned by the two people who were former employees of the company, and that was sustained. And then we were trying to have that offset and try that be treated. And the court said, you can't use that, even in good faith, because there was a finding that Toyota Lift had made a good faith tender of what it thought it owed. But it said, if it finally turns out you lose on that thing, you get the 15-day penalty. You don't get the doubling that happens here. And it's a completely inapposite case that we think. The case that, or the mention in the argument about the case being it was tried. Well, it can't be tried. If you've got a motion for summary judgment against you and it says it's decided as a matter of law, we cannot go to court and start talking about why it should not have been brought. We tried to contest it. We asked for reconsideration of it. We even made a motion for a new trial and amended on the grounds that there was improper motion for summary judgment granted. And the trial judge said that there was no right to handle a summary judgment issue in a motion for a new trial or amended findings. Instead, that has to be taken to the Court of Appeals and addressed here.
Do you disagree that offsets were tried?
I'm sorry?
You disagree that the claimed offsets were tried?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the problem that I had with the evidence and trying to make the offer of proof and the judge saying, you can't do it. I've already made a motion granted on summary judgment for that. And so that left that case, that part of the case completely out. We were not able to try that. Now, the other points that I think, I've only got 7 seconds, so I'd like to rely completely on my brief. I recognize the quote on page 48 on that gross. I know it was brought up. I didn't see it in the quote that I cited you either, but I know that was not a quote out of nowhere. I mean, they wouldn't have made it up.
Yeah. No, I was trying to figure out where, though.
Okay.
Because it matters chronologically if it's trial versus summary judgment.
Yes.
I think in evaluating what the court did.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
Okay.